The Big Short by Michael Lewis. Imagine getting a loan to buy a house, only to have it frozen due to a lack of credit and the skepticism of financial institutions. It's like stepping onto a vast frozen river. Under your feet, it seems solid and endless. You see people crossing it without hesitation, and you wonder how they don't fear the ice breaking beneath them. You might think that taking the first step cautiously will ease your insecurity, but then you hear a deep, resonant crack beneath you. This sound is the alarm you need to react and avoid breaking through the thin ice. This feeling mirrors the uncertainty in the financial world, especially when buying a house. The mortgage problem had already impacted the global economy. To illustrate, 2008 was one of the toughest years for the world economy. The United States faced one of the largest and most severe financial crises, starting with the housing bubble. This term refers to a rapid and significant decline in housing prices, often accompanied by an increase in mortgage defaults and foreclosures. Many people bought homes by borrowing from banks, but as housing prices fell, defaults increased, causing huge losses for major financial institutions. This collapse triggered a liquidity crisis, leading to the failure of banks like Lehman Brothers, a loss in share value, and a major stock market crash. The impact was felt worldwide, leading to a global recession, high unemployment rates, and the need for substantial government bailouts to stabilize the economy. Just as the frozen river represents the precarious financial system, the 2008 financial crisis was a frozen lake, vast and seemingly unshakable, built on the collective faith that housing prices would never fall, that risk had been eliminated, that Wall Street's smartest minds had mastered the game. The entire system was balanced on the assumption that the ice would hold. But a few people, outsiders, skeptics, those willing to listen for the cracks, realized the truth. They saw what others refused to see, that beneath the surface, the foundations were already breaking apart. This is their story, not just of finance, but of perception of what it takes to recognize an illusion before it shatters beneath your feet. Chapter 1, A Secret Origin Story. Every financial crisis has a beginning, though its origins are rarely obvious in the moment. The collapse of 2008, one of the most consequential economic failures in modern history, was not the result of a singular miscalculation or a stroke of bad luck. It was the product of years of misplaced confidence, built on the assumption that housing prices could only rise. Wall Street embraced this belief with unshakable conviction, constructing an intricate financial system on top of it. Banks, traders, and even regulators subscribed to the idea that risk had been neutralized, that financial engineering had rendered traditional market downturns a relic of the past. But history has a way of humbling such certainty, and as Michael Lewis illustrates, complexity does not eliminate risk, it merely disguises it. Among the few who saw the impending disaster was Michael Burry, an unconventional hedge fund manager whose intellect thrived on meticulous analysis rather than market sentiment. A former physician with a relentless focus on details, Burry immersed himself in the fine print of mortgage-backed securities, scrutinizing them with the precision of a diagnostician searching for hidden pathology. What he uncovered was staggering. These supposedly stable investments were saturated with subprime loans, mortgages extended to borrowers who had little ability to repay them. Banks had repackaged and resold these loans so many times that even they no longer understood the risks they carried. Burry did. He saw not just market volatility, but structural inevitability. The system was on borrowed time, and while the rest of Wall Street celebrated its strength, he decided to bet against it. Lewis presents an essential truth here. Financial crises do not emerge from sudden shocks, but from a slow accumulation of misjudgments, ignored warnings, and misplaced incentives. They are not acts of fate, but the consequences of decisions made by those who mistake complexity for stability. And, as Burry's story shows, those who dare to challenge the prevailing wisdom are often dismissed until reality forces the world to catch up. Chapter 2, In the Land of the Blind. Wall Street was built on confidence on the unshakable belief that its models, institutions, and brightest minds possessed a superior understanding of the market. But what if that confidence was fundamentally flawed? What if the financial system was not guided by wisdom, but by a dangerous complacency? Steve Eisman was among the few willing to confront these unsettling questions. A sharp, brutally candid investor with little tolerance for corporate deception, Eisman had spent years dissecting financial institutions and exposing risks they preferred to overlook. When he turned his attention to the mortgage industry, what he uncovered defied logic. Mortgage lenders were approving loans indiscriminately, packaging them into securities, and marketing them as if they carried the same level of security as government bonds. Wall Street firms, convinced of their own brilliance, were not merely purchasing these securities, they were leveraging them to unprecedented levels, exponentially amplifying the potential consequences of a market downturn. Yet the most alarming revelation was not the recklessness itself, but the ignorance that sustained it. The executives overseeing billion-dollar portfolios of mortgage-backed securities were not malevolent architects of financial ruin. They were, in many cases, true believers in a system they failed to fully comprehend. Lewis underscores a sobering reality. Financial catastrophes do not stem solely from greed. They arise when those in positions of power cease to question their own assumptions, mistaking complexity for control and confidence for infallibility. Chapter 3, How Can a Guy Who Can't Speak English Lie? The housing bubble wasn't just about bad financial models or reckless investment strategies. It was built on deception, both deliberate and unintentional. Mortgage brokers, driven by commissions, were the boots on the ground, funneling people into loans they had no business taking. The system rewarded volume, not quality. And the faster brokers could push loans through, the more money they made. One of the most revealing moments in Lewis's narrative comes when Eisman and his team sit down with an executive from a mortgage company that specialized in lending to immigrants with little to no financial history. The executive boasts about their success, explaining how they were approving loans for people who barely spoke English, using contracts so convoluted that even native speakers would struggle to understand them. When asked if these borrowers truly grasped the terms of their loans, the executive scoffs, "How can a guy who can't speak English lie?" It was a moment of staggering arrogance and willful ignorance, a glimpse into an industry so detached from reality that it had convinced itself that fraud wasn't just unlikely, but impossible. Lewis wants us to see that the collapse wasn't caused by a few bad actors. It was the inevitable result of a system where no one took responsibility. The borrowers didn't understand what they were signing, the brokers didn't care, and the banks, trusting in their flawed models, kept feeding the machine. Chapter 4, How to Harvest a Migrant Worker. To fully grasp the absurdity of the housing bubble, one had to look beyond Wall Street and into the communities that bore the brunt of its collapse. California's Inland Empire was one such epicenter and expanse of hastily constructed developments where entire neighborhoods stood eerily vacant, casualties of loans that should never have been approved in the first place. Eisman and his team traveled there to witness the devastation firsthand. Street after street was lined with foreclosed homes abandoned by borrowers who had been lured into mortgages that defied basic financial logic, monthly payments set to double or triple within a few years, hidden fees that ensured long-term insolvency. Many of these homeowners were migrant workers, earning barely enough to sustain themselves, yet somehow granted loans worth millions. The rationale behind these approvals was non-existent, but it was irrelevant. As long as banks could continue bundling and selling these risky loans, the machine kept running. Lewis underscores a fundamental truth. The financial system was not merely engaged in reckless speculation. It had become entirely detached from reality. Wall Street had reduced homeownership to little more than an abstract calculation, oblivious to the lives being upended in the process. The impending crash would not be a mere market correction. It would be a reckoning. Chapter 5, Accidental Capitalists. Not every investor who foresaw the collapse was a Wall Street insider. Some stumbled upon it almost by chance. Charlie Ledley and Jamie Mai were two such outsiders underdogs operating a modest hedge fund out of a garage, with neither an extensive financial background nor connections to the industry's power players. Yet through sheer intellectual curiosity and relentless inquiry, they uncovered what billion-dollar firms had overlooked. What they found was a market so convoluted, so untethered from rational analysis, that even seasoned investors failed to grasp the true nature of their own holdings. Mortgage-backed securities were being assigned top-tier credit ratings despite being saturated with toxic loans. The more Ledley and Mai scrutinized the system, the more evident it became. The financial world was not built on sound analysis, but on blind faith. They realized that if they could find a way to short these securities to bet against them, they could transform a modest investment into an extraordinary windfall. Executing that bet, however, was no simple feat. The financial establishment was so entrenched in its own illusions of stability that few institutions were willing to provide the necessary instruments to wager against the housing market. The notion itself was considered absurd. Yet Ledley and Mai persisted, tracking down the obscure derivatives that would allow them to stake their position. Their story is not merely one of financial gain. It is a testament to the power of skepticism in a world intoxicated by its own certainty. Lewis illustrates a compelling truth. Those who predicted the crash were not financial savants privy to hidden knowledge. They were outsiders who simply refused to accept prevailing narratives at face value, who dared to question what others blindly embraced as fact. And sometimes that is all it takes to perceive what remains invisible to the rest of the world. Chapter 6, Spider-Man at the Venetian. Las Vegas, a city built on risk, was the perfect backdrop for one of the most surreal moments in the financial crisis. In 2007, Wall Street's biggest players gathered at a financial conference at the Venetian, a luxury casino, to discuss the state of the mortgage bond market. To the casual observer, everything still seemed normal. Markets were booming, bonuses were flowing, and the idea that the financial world was about to implode was unthinkable. But for the few investors who had bet against the housing market, the trip to Las Vegas was something else entirely. It was their confirmation that Wall Street was in complete denial. Steve Eisman, always blunt and unimpressed by arrogance, met with executives from major banks who still insisted that subprime mortgages were safe. As he listened to their blind confidence, it became clear. They didn't just misunderstand the risks, they didn't even believe risk existed. The conference was filled with traders and bankers who had built fortunes on mortgage-backed securities, convinced that their models would never fail. It was as if they were playing a game without realizing the casino was rigged against them. The moment encapsulated what Lewis wants us to see. Wall Street wasn't just reckless, it was delusional. The people inside the machine couldn't see the collapse coming because they were too busy convincing themselves it wasn't possible. Chapter 7, The Great Treasure Hunt. By 2007, the signs of trouble in the housing market were becoming harder to ignore. Default rates on subprime mortgages were rising, home prices had stopped climbing, and the once booming mortgage-backed securities market was showing signs of distress. Yet most of Wall Street remained unconcerned. These developments were seen as temporary setbacks, not as indications of a looming crisis. The belief that housing prices would always rise was still deeply rooted. For those who had bet against the system, however, this was the moment they had anticipated. Michael Burry, Charlie Ledley, Jamie Mai, and Steve Eisman had spent years analyzing the weaknesses hidden within complex financial instruments. They understood that behind Wall Street's confidence, the foundations were crumbling. But there was a major challenge. Collecting on their bets was not as straightforward as they had expected. The credit default swaps they had used to short the housing market were theoretically worth enormous sums, yet the banks on the other side of these trades were reluctant to acknowledge their losses. Lewis emphasizes an important reality. Even when Wall Street makes catastrophic mistakes, it does not surrender easily. The institutions that had driven the crisis were now attempting to delay its consequences, adjusting valuations and creating roadblocks to avoid paying out. The same firms that had eagerly bought and sold risky assets were suddenly insisting that those assets were still stable. It was a stark reminder that in finance, being correct is not always enough. Turning that correctness into actual profit is another challenge entirely. Chapter 8, The Long Quiet. As 2007 gave way to 2008, the financial system settled into an unsettling calm. The housing market was visibly deteriorating, foreclosures were accelerating, and banks were showing signs of distress, yet the full extent of the crisis had not yet reached Wall Street. The traders who had positioned themselves against subprime mortgages understood that the collapse was inevitable, but the delay in its unraveling tested their resolve. For Michael Burry, this period was particularly difficult. His investors, many of whom had never fully grasped the rationale behind his bet against the housing market, were becoming impatient. They saw an economy that, despite warning signs, had not yet crumbled. Banks remained operational, financial institutions were still standing, and doubt began to creep in. To them, Burry's strategy appeared increasingly misguided. What they failed to recognize was that the system's failure was not a question of if, but when. This chapter underscores a central theme of The Big Short. Recognizing an impending crisis is not the same as convincing others of its inevitability. Those who had correctly anticipated the collapse were not only met with market resistance, but also with skepticism from their own peers and investors. The financial disaster was unfolding gradually, and for those who had placed their bets, the waiting was as agonizing as the crash itself. Chapter 9, A Death of Interest. By mid-2008, the illusion could no longer hold. Bear Stearns, one of Wall Street's biggest investment banks, had collapsed, and suddenly, the impossible seemed possible. Confidence in the financial system began to crack. and the reality of the subprime crisis could no longer be ignored. Yet even as mortgage-backed securities imploded, many of Wall Street's top executives remained in denial. Steve Eisman, always drawn to the absurdity of human behavior, watched in disbelief as financial professionals continued to insist that the worst had passed. Some even believed that the crisis would be contained to a few firms, that the system itself was strong enough to withstand the damage. But Lewis makes it clear they were wrong. The financial industry had spent years convincing itself that risk had been eliminated, that the intricate mathematical models behind mortgage bonds made them fail-proof. That belief wasn't just optimistic, it was lethal. As the crisis deepened, it became clear that the very institutions that had created the disaster had no plan for what to do when it all fell apart. The government was forced to intervene, pumping money into failing banks to prevent a total collapse. But for those who had seen it coming, Eisman, Burry, Ledley, and Mai, the most shocking realization wasn't that the system had failed. It was that even in the face of ruin, the people who had built the disaster still refused to take responsibility. Chapter 10, Two Men in a Boat. As the financial system lay in ruins, Michael Lewis shifts focus to a moment of reflection. Charlie Ledley and Jamie Mai, two of the investors who had foreseen the collapse, distanced themselves from the turmoil of Wall Street, retreating to a boat as they attempt to make sense of the crisis's aftermath. Their analysis had been correct, their investments had yielded extraordinary returns, yet any sense of triumph was overshadowed by the scale of destruction unfolding around them. Their predictions had not merely been financial abstractions, they had tangible, devastating consequences. Across the country, families were losing their homes, life savings were being wiped out, and unemployment was soaring. Meanwhile, the very institutions responsible for the collapse were being shielded from its worst effects. Instead of accountability, the financial sector received government bailouts, reinforcing a system that prioritized corporate survival over individual livelihoods. Lewis highlights a sobering reality. The Big Short is not simply a story about financial miscalculations, but about the broader failures of oversight, ethics, and responsibility. The same market forces that had dismissed dissenting voices now sought to preserve their own interests at any cost. For Ledley and Mai, the moment was no longer about profit. It was an unsettling confirmation of a system that had little incentive to change, no matter how catastrophic the consequences. Closing thoughts. The financial crisis of 2008 was not a natural disaster, nor was it an unforeseeable event. It was a slow-burning catastrophe, engineered by misplaced incentives, unchecked greed, and a dangerously misguided belief in the infallibility of financial models. At its core, The Big Short is not just about the mechanics of Wall Street's greatest failure. It is about the individuals who saw through the illusion while everyone else remained willfully blind. Michael Lewis exposes a world where those in power bankers, traders, and regulators failed not because they lacked intelligence, but because they lacked curiosity. The few who predicted the collapse were not insiders with privileged access. They were outsiders who simply asked the questions that no one else dared to. They didn't take the market's wisdom at face value. They looked closer, dug deeper, and recognize the contradiction at the heart of the system, the idea that infinite growth could be built on a foundation of unsustainable debt. But perhaps the most unsettling takeaway from The Big Short is that history has a way of repeating itself. The same forces that fueled the housing bubble short-term incentives, financial complexity, and institutional complacency remain embedded in the system. The names and financial products may change, but the cycle of boom and bust endures. Lewis leaves us with an implicit challenge. Will we learn from the past, or will we once again mistake complexity for stability, mistaking speculation for progress until the next inevitable reckoning arrives?